Coming up next is the Professor James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, February 15th, 2007, and I'm going to cover a bit of recent news, breaking news, so to speak, do a bit of commentary, and go into tonight's main topic, which will prepare you a bit, I would say, for the new book release, which is coming out next week. And by the way, just for your information, the pamphlet, Surviving Planet X pamphlet, just went through another printing. It's in its, I don't know how many, seventh, eighth printing at this point. I don't even remember. But that's a little item, 60 pages long, which has been just a gem. People love that. So if you don't have a copy, make sure you get one. Go to the webpage. They're $6.95, which is almost giving it away. It's a supplement to the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, the first book in the series. And we just have a new supply right now, so make sure you do get one of those. And one of these days, I've always promised this, and I've been so busy, that I'll just have to put it in my mental calendar to do a special show talking you through the process of building a calendar based on a pile of rocks. And that sounds like a kind of a primitive thing to do, but it's very essential. It's one of the most essential survival skills on the planet. And we find these rock calendars all around the world, basically. There's hundreds of them, literally hundreds of them in the American Southwest. And the people that lived a long time ago knew how to do this. It was essential to their survival because the biggest issue is to know when the planting and harvest season are and to plant appropriately. And imagine there was a worldwide catastrophe or some kind of an event where the first thing you would lose track of would be time and the calendar, the time and the date. It wouldn't be but a few days and you would just lose track of it. Remember the ancient sailors and mariners went to great lengths to record time and keep track of time and dates. In fact, it was said that one of the proofs of the world being round was the fact that Magellan, when he went around the world, his calendar was off by one day from the calendars of the European calendars where he left, you know, before he sailed around the world, which is very interesting. And of course, one might think, well, he just lost track of a day, but they didn't. They didn't lose track of a day or a second. And so anyway, building a calendar is one of the most critical issues you could possibly face in a survival situation. And this little pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, contains the instructions, and it's quite simple, but you have to practice at it a little bit. The average guy on the street is not going to be able to pick this up, especially in a survival situation. So what I wanted to do one of these days is to go through that. I won't do it tonight, but make sure you get a copy of the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. If you use mail, just send in $6.95 to P.O. Box 58 Navarre, Minnesota 55392, and $6.95, and we'll send you, just ask for the surviving pamphlet. Make sure you got a copy of that so that when I do that show, you'll have your pamphlet in hand, because there are charts and tables that you have to fill out, and it's particular to where you live and where you are on the planet. So somebody from Indiana would have a different chart than, say, somebody from Texas. The book is the same, but when you fill in your details, that's how things are different. And you would construct a calendar and you would know the time of year, the dates, everything. And even if there was something really, really cataclysmic, such as a global change or a big planetary celestial object coming by that really ripped us and changed the calendar even, you would be able to reconstruct the calendar so you knew the seasons, the number of days of the year. And remember that the ancients tell us that the calendar continued to change even after some of the major celestial events that passed by Earth. So at any rate, go to the webpage, or if you use mail order, get a copy of the pamphlet. It's the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet. $6.95, or if you use mail order, send it to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Or you could get that as part of the book set. It comes with the book set. And so if you sent $35, you could get the three book set. And for $60, you would get the weather book. You would get the four book set, including the pamphlet. So just a couple options there. On to the next topic. The new book release is at hand. Oh, my goodness. Now, I've said before that writing a book, for me, some people write a book and they hand it off to their publisher and they have whole staff of people and the government pays for part of the printing or, you know, whatever. But when I produce a book, I do it myself, and it's under very controlled circumstances. And nobody sees it, nobody gets a copy of it until it's actually released. Nobody even knows the title. So at any rate, the new book is at hand, and it does have a DVD in the back cover. It has a lecture, a couple-part lecture dealing with the topic, and so it's a book DVD set. And the book itself will be, it's 100 pages from cover to cover. And of course, in there you have the title page and other issues. This book was a bit more complicated because it had a good deal of background work that had to be produced, including patents, trademarks, copyrights, a whole laundry list of other issues that occurred with this book that I've never dealt with specifically in the other books. So at any rate, the new book, I'll be announcing within the next week the kickoff shows for the new book. And of course, the people who made orders put in orders already for that 56 with the weather book, those people will get their copies very early in the shipping. And so they will be guaranteed a shipping of their book. And those particular books, those people will have them signed. Unfortunately, for the general orders, I'm not in a position to sign them. And sometimes people ask that. Maybe someday I will be, but right now they go out of a different location and all of that. But the people who ordered the 56, one of the 56 copies of the first edition weather book plus the new book, and they, of course, ordered it not even knowing what the title was, and those sold out in a couple days. It just gives an indication of the awareness people have of my work. Now, the new book, and I will not announce the title until it comes off on some of the shows, so just keep tuned to this show, and if this is your only contact with me is through this show, then keep listening. Next week I will have a whole list of show announcements where the book will be released, and then also the webpage, the jmccsci.com. Or if you have a link, the jmccanniscience.com homepage, if you type it in to your browser, simply type in JMCCSCI, short for J. McCanny Science. It's just seven letters, www.jmccs is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo. JMCCSCI.com. Go there and keep an eye on the news release or the release dates for the book. And as I said before, this book will take an entirely new direction. My first book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes, discusses the electrical nature of the solar system, the history of my work, dealing with electricity and magnetism in outer space and how it affects us. Talks about the Earth changes. The second, of course, is the supplement, which I just talked about, Surviving Planet X Passage, is the name of the 60-page, we call it a pamphlet. It's probably a little bigger than your average pamphlet, but 60 pages is the second mini-book, so to speak. Then back to the regular format books, Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. The last book in the series to date is called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, written for the general public. And now the new book coming up, those books all dealt with the electrical nature of the solar system, with weather, space physics, cosmology, the redshift, the induced electric dipole redshift, explaining how the Big Bang theory is incorrect. Those are the topics covered in the first set of books. The new book is going to take an entirely new direction, and throughout my more public career, people have said there's kind of some missing time in my history, and so I decided that this would be a good time to release at least some of the information on my past, on particular things that I've done throughout my lifetime. And you'll find some people on the internet trying to badmouth me, saying that I've never done anything. Well, it's simply not true. I've had to keep much of this private because you have to understand in my 30 years of dealing with the space industry and the science industry, etc., I've been under constant attack for my views. One thing they try to do is go for your source of income, to try and destroy you personally, to drag down your name, to head off anybody who may work with you and cause success. So as a result, I've had to keep a good part of my past very private. And so at this point, I've made arrangements for some of this. Now, I still use many of my old lifelong contacts, and so I'm not going to give those out. And I never give out names or very specifics, because there again, you have a lot of, this happens, I guess, when you get into the public eye. You have a lot of imposter wannabes that all of a sudden start jumping all over the people that I name either on this show or in a book or in a writing or in a lecture or whatever. So I've learned the hard way. I cannot release the names or specific identities of, say, corporations that I've worked with in the past, things like that, for a very good reason, because all of a sudden the idiots out there, both the government disinformation crew and the wannabe yo-yos that populate the internet, all of a sudden try and jump on these people or entities, and it becomes a big mess. So anyway, for those reasons, I don't give specifics about some of the details. But at any rate, with this new book, you're going to see information about my past that has never been released before. And it's pertinent to the topic in the book because some of this work and a lot of what I do is very much in the background and not public. What you see, what I release to the public, is information that has been many times through the ringer in very private communities and science communities. And that's the way a lot of people have to work today for the reasons I just stated. So anyway, the bottom line is this new book is taking an entirely new direction as far as the public's awareness of what I do. The work in this new book I've been working on for a very long time, and this book is really the culmination of many decades of work. And when people first see it, they're going to go, I know what the reaction is going to be. The initial reaction is going to be, huh? Like, and it's going to be kind of like, well, anyway, it's going to be kind of a, people are not going to quite understand what the point of this book is. But then after you start to grasp the implications of this book that is just coming out right now and the DVD, which supplements it, you're going to find out that this is possibly one of the most important topics of the past 2,500 years, or going back into what we call the dawn of history. So without saying much more about that, just stay tuned. The new book DVD release is coming out within the next week, and it will be available, so just stay tuned. On to some topics, and the main science topic for tonight, which is going to get you prepared, it's going to start to get you prepared for the new book. I'm going to talk about a topic that is near and dear to many of our hearts today, which is the topic of snowflakes. And you might think, snowflakes, that's an interesting topic, but I don't know if I'm really interested in snowflakes. Well, after I get done talking about this, I think you will be. But at any rate, that's the main science topic for tonight. And it goes back, remember that I wanted you, and if you haven't done this already, January 11th, make sure you listen to the archive of my January 11th, 2007 radio show. The whole show is on repeatability in science. And in fact, I listened to that myself the other night, and I thought, you know, this is something that people on the street need to understand, and scientists simply ignore it, the topic of repeatability in science. But anyway, it is a critical issue. And then there's another issue that comes along called symmetry. Now, when you look at pictures of snowflakes, they are amazingly symmetrical. Six-sided symmetry. So anyway, I'm going to get into that in a minute and talk about some fundamental properties in nature that help them become symmetrical and repeatable with this repeatable symmetry, although each snowflake is different. And so there's some very fundamental properties of nature which carries over into, say, us, people. You look at everybody around you, you might have some what you call identical twins. And you look at those identical twins, and they're really different. The mom can identify this one from that one, whereas I remember meeting identical twins throughout my lifetime. And I would look at them, and I go, gee, you know, I'm never going to be able to tell these apart. But once you get to know them and know the subtle characteristics, there are differences. So really, in a sense, no two human beings are exactly the same. There are differences, and in general, you can look around a crowd and you can identify everybody by their name because they look different. But we're all human beings. We all have the same genetic makeup, and the building blocks are all the same. So fundamentally, we are all the same, and we are repeatable. So anyway, I'll get into that topic a little further when I talk about snowflakes tonight on the main science topic. But first, a few quick topics here. I'm not sure if I covered this before, but there was an article, I saw it in many news releases. They talked about builders of Stonehenge had been found. And whenever I see something in the popular media, as a friend of mine said recently, pretty much if you read something in the popular media, take the opposite of it, and it's probably the opposite of what you read is probably more true than what you read, which I thought was a good observation. And that's really true. But anyway, this article, the many articles I saw, builders of Stonehenge had been found. And of course, Stonehenge is this rock calendar, speaking of rock calendars, is a big rock stone calendar in the plains over in England. And had a little interruption here. The Stonehenge, it said that the builders of Stonehenge were found. But when you looked into these articles, they found a small Neolithic town where possibly a very small number of people lived. They built stone houses that were very primitive, and they said, well, there was kind of a path between where this little town was found and Stonehenge. So they assumed that that's the group of people who built it. And then as you read through the article, it said, well, at least they had some ceremonies there. Well, yeah, if I lived next to Stonehenge, I'd probably go over there and build a fire and camp out and have a few ceremonies too. But to put the title up there to draw your attention that the builders of Stonehenge had been found, what a stretch of the truth. So anyway, I really get disgusted, and I hope kids out there listen to this show and start learning how to read the newspaper and listen to the news, because as I said, most of what you hear, you take the opposite, and that's really the truth, or at least a better part of the truth. And a lot of adults, too, who get their news from either the internet, major news media, or the nightly news, or the newspaper, learn how to read them. Okay, on to the next topic, the snowstorm in the Northeast. What a disaster for these people. But, as I understand it, it is still not a record, or not all the records have been broken. These people in this area had much larger snowstorms in the past. So at any rate, even though we think this is incredible, it is not the biggest one that has ever happened in that area. And of course, it's what they call lake effect. The big lakes generate a tremendous amount of moisture, and that moisture gets drawn in by circular wind patterns up in the atmosphere, drawing that moisture into the cold air coming from the north, compressing it, making snow. And once again, we're going to talk about snow. So very interesting that we have a lot of snow up in the northeast part of the country, and we're going to be talking about the individual little particles that make up all that big white stuff, the snow flakes. But I just wanted to mention that the northeast and those areas east of the lakes get those tremendous snowfalls, and that is not out of the ordinary. The only question I have in particular, I mean, it's not ordinary as far as we're concerned, but historically this has been going on for a very long time. But my only question is, how did those poor Indians, Native Americans, live up in those areas back, you know, before, you know, we had plows and roads and or anything? They lived out there and somehow survived, and you know that they got buried under 10 or 15 feet of snow, just like they do out in the Dakotas sometimes where it drifts. And how did those people live through that? They must have been some pretty tough, smart people. How many people today could live through that just for a day, let alone a whole winter with your whole band of people? Here's a little comment, and something that everybody should do, and since it's springtime, I would highly recommend, in fact, I'm not even recommending this, I'm just telling you to do it. You need to do this. You have to have this. Just like I tell people the same about water filters. You need your own gravity feed water filter, but that's not what I'm about to say. You need also your very own seed bank. Now, a seed bank, you go and get not hybrid seeds, not the ones that only grow for 1 year and then will never grow again. You have to get what they call heirloom seeds. These are the real seeds. These are the ones that your grandmother used or your great-grandmother planted, got the seeds in the spring and planted them, and then fall, kept the best seeds for the planting of the next year. And I've started to do this on the scale that I have time for, but here's something you should do. Get a catalog. There's many. I'm not going to recommend any out in particular because there's many good sources of seeds out there, and there are places they are very specific that they grow their own seeds, and they're heirloom seeds. Make sure they're a reputable dealer, and then buy all of the varieties of plants that you would like to eat, tomatoes and squash and potatoes and I don't know, whatever else, you know, peas and beans and everything else that you would like to eat if there were nothing else around at the grocery store, etc. And buy the seeds, buy enough for this year's planting, and then I would say buy twice or three times that. And take the ones that you are not going to use this spring and use one of these vacuum packing devices. They come with the bags, and there's like a little vacuum unit, and it seals the bag after it sucks all of the air out of the bag. And put your seeds in there and store them in a nice, dry, cool area, probably, I would say, 40 to 45 degrees, somewhere in that area. And or some people even freeze them, but make sure you've got all the air and water moisture out of those packets. So just take the packets of seeds, put them into one of these vacuum sealing bags, and put it in your little machine, draw all the air out, and vacuum seal it, and take those and put them in a safe place. And believe me, there might be some day when that is the only source of food you might have. So, and this is something, as I said, and if it goes bad and you don't need them someday, 10, 15 years down the line, but remember, in old Egypt, they stored seeds. They knew the importance of this, and people, archaeologists, have found those seed banks even now. Down in southwestern United States, archaeologists have found the seed banks stored by Indians hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago from the native population that lived there. And there are plants, many of them, that don't even exist today. We have the corn plants that were used by the ancient Mayan. You can buy those. Anasazi corn, you can buy that on the market today commercially. And these are the corns, the grains, etc., raised by people in ancient times. They were chosen or evolved through many centuries of selection by these people to be hardy and grow in, say, a dry area or an extra wet area or whatever, so that these seeds are particularly, they were groomed and by natural selection by people who harvested and kept them and traded seeds with their friends. And now there are groups that have these seed banks, and you can buy these commercially. They're called heirloom seeds. I don't sell them myself, so I'm not going to make a penny off of telling you to do this. I'm not getting a kickback from anybody who might be selling these. But now is the springtime of year. Now is the time when they're stocked up and ready to sell to people. So go out and, like I said, buy what you need this year, whether it's a little window planting box or whether it's a big garden. Buy enough seed for what you're going to use this year. And then buy a good supply, put them in vacuum, put the little packets and envelopes, they usually are paper, put them in one of these vacuum sealed bags, seal it up, put it in a dark spot where it's going to stay dry and cool, and that may be, as I said, the only thing you may have to eat someday. Okay, next topic, just a quick advertisement, and this is a free advertisement also. It's just for some friends of mine. They run a thing called the UFO Congress. Bob and Terry and the family and the staff run this incredible event, and it's coming up in about a week. I think it starts the 28th of February, but just for all of the details, go to UFOCongress.com and get all of the details there. I myself will not be there this year. I have prior commitments, but I have in the past gone when I was not a speaker. I was a speaker there 2 years in a row from 2003. I was a speaker with dealing with the Planet X topic, which was very much peaking at that time, a tremendous amount of interest. And in the audience, I think there was an estimated 1,200 to 1,500 people at my talk. You know, so it was a very popular topic at that time. And the next year, I talked on a topic that is near and dear to me, my theoretical work called Electric Rivers to the Highways, and those videos of my talks are available on my website, the 2003 and 2004 UFO Congress. But the Congress itself is very professionally done. It's they've been doing this for a long time, so they really have a good professional staff that runs and operates the Congress, bringing people in from around the world to talk on topics dealing with every aspect of UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence. And so it's something that I highly recommend. If you can get down to Laughlin, Nevada for a day or a couple of days or the full week, I would highly recommend it. And so anyway, that's just a little free advertisement for my really good friend Bob and Terry and the family and the whole crew that run that. And a lot of my good friends, too, who actually attend every year. So very good show, program. The UFO Congress, Laughlin, Nevada, and I think it starts the 28th of February. Check their webpage, ufocongress.com. Okay, on to the next topic. Let me see if I have anything else here. As always, I encourage you to get a water filter. Oh, I do have some other topics. I'm sorry. But you can go to the 800 number, 800-983-JMCC. What's that on the phone? I've got to look at this. 5622. Oh, I've forgotten my own 800 number. Sorry. 800-983-5622. And that's the 800 number where you can get information for buying the Berkey filter and the shortwave special of books. And then also go to my webpage, JMCCS. Is in Sam, C-I, JMCCSCI.com, just seven letters. The Berkey water filter, I just can't tell you how much you need these. People are recognizing this all over the world. And just to give you a little information of what you get when you order one of these, the Berkey water filter is a tank. I believe it holds 3 to 4 gallons. A tank that sits on top of another tank. These are metal. They are extremely sturdy. They're portable. There's no electricity. There's no pressure. They don't hook up to your faucet. You simply pour water in the top. It filters through the black Berkey filter elements and comes out into the bottom as virus-free, bacteria-free. It takes out all of the bad stuff out of the water and leaves the minerals. Something that you have to understand, you cannot drink demineralized water because it will leach the minerals out of your body. So it's important to have the minerals in the water that come from the source of the water. So at any rate, the Berkey does that. And so you get the Berkey water filter, 2 black Berkey filters and 2 extra black Berkey filters, and I insist that people get those 2 extra ones. It's all part of the package, because it's like a car needing a spare tire. You wouldn't buy a car and say, "Well, gee, I don't want the spare tire." The spare tire only has value when you need it, if you know what I mean. That spare tire sits in the back of your car for months, sometimes years, and you never use it, and you go, gee, that's pretty worthless. How come I have that? Well, it only has value the day that you need it. Then it's the most valuable thing you have. That's why I insist that people get a spare set of the black Berkey filters, and I include them in the package I sell. I only sell 1 package, no variables. The black Berkey filter, you get the 2 filters plus the extra 2 for a total of 4 filters, and you get the free shortwave radio. The shortwave radio is a Kaito, K-A-I-T-O, Kaito brand world receiver. It's a WRX-911. It's small. It's about as big as, it's a little smaller than, say, a VHS videotape. It's about maybe 2/3 of that size. So it's very portable. It'll run up to 400 hours on two AA batteries, which is extremely important, and it really pulls in shortwave. So you can hear this show anywhere in the world on that shortwave radio if the signal, if you're getting a good signal. So at any rate, the Black Berkey filters, four of them, the big Berkey water filter, the tanks with the spigot at the bottom, you can use it in your house. I use mine in my kitchen every day. I don't have a water filter, one of those pressurized ones, on my water system in my house. I don't have one of those because if it forms a little crack in the filter, you know what? All of your water goes through the crack in the filter, and it doesn't do any good at all. So the pressurized water filters, I would stay away from. I don't use them myself. I use my Berkey filter on my counter, and that's the drinking water that I use myself. I have a big pitcher in the refrigerator, and that's what I use. So at any rate, so you get the big Berkey filter, the four Berkey elements, Black Berkey elements, and the free radio, and free shipping, all for $315. So at any rate, I highly recommend it. If you don't have one, get one. You need it. It's not something that is, well, you know, as with a spare tire, you only need it on that day when you need it, but when you need it, it's the most important thing in your life. Fresh water. Don't leave home without it, you know, as they say. At any rate, okay, a couple quick topics here before going to the science topic. You'll see this article floating around in science magazines or on the internet, all over. Cosmic rays blamed for global warming. Oh my goodness. Let's blame it on something that's far away and out of reach and far away in time and space. Cosmic rays causing our global warming. Whoa. Okay, folks, not even the mainstream scientists are buying this one, which I'm surprised at. But oddly enough, I want to make this point, in global warming, as you know, they say that because of the haze and the growing amount of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide in the air, that, and water vapor, that it's causing the Earth to heat up. What I think is comical about this cosmic rays from the far reach of the galaxy causing global warming is they take the opposite stance. They say it causes vapor to form in the atmosphere and that cools our planet. I'm not going to get into either side of that because both of these are disinformation deluxe, and the only reason they're allowed in the press is to keep you from understanding the true basis of global warming, and that is that the sun, our sun, the thing up in the sky every day, causes the heating of our planet. It's putting out a lot more heat, and the reason for that is the passage of comets through the solar system. That is one of the reasons. The other reason is that the sun is variable. It isn't constant, and if you understand that the sun is not constant on a short-term basis like we're dealing with here, whether it's 10 or 20 or 30 or 100 years, it is not explained by a model of the sun which puts fusion in the core of the sun. It simply is not true. The fusion of the sun is up at the surface. We see comets interacting with it. We see it changing on a daily basis, both on a localized level on the surface of the sun and on a frequency that could be in terms of hours or days or months or years, but the sun is not constant. And so, at any rate, I've talked about this many times. So when I see these articles coming out, the only reason I can imagine why they're allowed to be published is to keep you from knowing the real cause of global warming. The other cause of global warming, of course, is that we are coming out of an ice age. And on the tail end of that ice age, as we came out of the ice age, the warming was very slow, but on the tail end, which we're in right now, the warming is very rapid. So we're just getting back to normal. There was an article this week again on cold fusion, tabletop fusion, and amazingly enough, these arguments still are controversial, let's put it that way. But at any rate, I don't have time to really go into that today. I'm going to go directly to the science topic, which deals with snowflakes. Okay, now everybody has seen snowflakes. You can catch them on your tongue. You do that when you were a little kid. I remember we used to catch them and then let other people look at them, because they would sit there for just a minute, or they'd land on your face, and you could look at, and you could tell just by looking with your eyes that these were very symmetrically, very symmetrical objects. And so I want to talk about just that fact. Now, let's look at the fact that every snowflake is different. Theoretically, not any two snowflakes are alike, and I've never tested that. Potentially, you might, if you look through every snowflake that had ever been made, whether on the other side of the universe or on our side of the universe, every snowflake ever made, if you could look at them all, you might find two that are pretty close to the same. And but on an average day, when you're looking at snow coming down, you'd be hard-pressed to find any two that are alike. In fact, there's many different crystalline forms. But what's interesting is they all take on a six-sided, some are three-sided like little triangles, and some are crystallines like little needles. But your average, the very vast majority of snowflakes are six-sided symmetry, two-dimensional symmetry. And now the arms are growing out in six different directions, and those little tentacle arms moving out in six different directions all are exactly the same. In very complex structures, the structure on this arm up here is exactly the same as the other five arms as they grow out in the space. Now, when I've talked about galaxies forming, and that galaxies had to form from the center outwards because of the need to explain the symmetry. It is such a fundamental property of galaxies that the theories that are available today in the standard science journal articles and in, that are popularized and that require dark matter to make them work have missed the boat right from the beginning. They didn't even get out of kindergarten, let alone should they be looking at light curves or other data. For the simple reason that when we look out in the universe, all of the galaxies are very symmetrical. If you take a picture of any galaxy, you look at one side, the star densities, the warping, the any of the structure in the galaxy, the gaps where there are no stars, the bands, the barred galaxies with their bars and then breaks and then another bar, etc., etc. When you look at these galaxies, there's all kinds of different properties, but if you look diametrically opposed from one a particular feature across the nucleus of the galaxy and the, out to the other side, the exact same distance, you'll find exactly the same property, whether it's a lack of stars, whether it's a bright star cluster, whether it's a bar or a warping, you will find the symmetry across the nucleus to be consistent throughout the galaxies. So the process of forming galaxies has to reflect that symmetry, and the same is true for snowflakes. So the question is, what is there in a snowflake? Now, I've talked about just briefly about galaxies. I've talked about that many times, and I have a paper which was published in the peer-reviewed astrophysics journals in 1980 called Continuing Galactic Formation, where the material would come in, coalesce around the galactic nucleus, and then come spraying out in the form of two arms, and that would form the stars and the star systems. But what is there in a snowflake that can emanate out in these six directions? And by the way, why is it six directions? Why doesn't a snowflake have two directions or four directions or eight directions? Why is it always six? Well, I'm not going to answer that question tonight. You'll have to look in my new book to find the answer to that particular question. But I want to talk tonight about the source of signaling, or the intelligence, let's put it, that creates the signals that go out in those six different directions, and why What is the source of that energy? Well, let's go back and let's talk about some great physics that was done back in the 90s. And this was done by scientists at Caltech. And I want to reference these people because they have such incredibly good work. You can go to, snowcrystals.com. It's a site that I would highly recommend that you look at after this show, so you can go there. And their material is copyrighted, and they've got very good protection on it. So I want to reference these people, and you can look at their pictures of snowflakes and the snowflakes that they grew in a laboratory. So they were talking about the electric snow crystal growth systems. They tried to grow crystals, duplicate atmospheric conditions, and grow ice crystals, that is, snowflakes, in the laboratory. And then they got the idea to put some pins in their snowflake generation chambers. And the snowflakes would grow on the pinhead, but when they applied an electric field to the pinhead and hit a certain threshold of voltage, all of a sudden they started generating snowflakes just like you see in nature. Now, this is really incredible physics. But the point I want to make is, okay, now that you've seen the conditions, the temperatures, the atmospheric pressure, the humidity, the density of air, all of the properties, the chemical what we call doping, or the trace chemicals that are in the air, the dust that starts the actual snowflake, and you start to see that the snowflake builds around a small dust particle, and it begins to generate this six-sided symmetry. And as I said in my new book, I'm talking about why there is six-sided symmetry. But the other question, which I'm going to talk about tonight, is where does that electric field come from up in space when snowflakes are forming by the zillions in a blizzard that's up there and is just about to dump all of this onto you with you and your little shovel down here, and you have to shovel it for the next 2 days. But they're forming these incredibly complex six-sided symmetrical snowflakes up there, every one that is different. But we have to know that the process that creates these snowflakes is exactly the same. So that is a fundamental important, and that's where the concept of repeatability comes in. There is a process in nature that is repeatable. That is the key here. There is a process in nature that is repeatable. And it creates symmetry. One of the things that scientists love to see in nature is symmetry, whether it's in a galaxy, the largest structure in the universe, or whether it's in a little teeny snowflake. And as I said, go to this site, snowcrystals.com. That's the site, snowcrystals. Crystals is spelled crystals.com. And tell them Jim McCanny sent you. But anyway, great, great physics done to identify, and then good historical write-ups on the development of snow crystals and snowflakes using pins in a chamber that they built to grow snowflakes with an electric field set up on the tip of the point of the pin. So anyway, where does this electric field come from in outer space? Well, gee, that's something that I happen to be studying kind of all my life. And so I know a little bit about it. I've talked before, my weather book talks about this, that the electric fields from the ionosphere, that's what Tesla was tapping into. He was able to short out basically a path from the ionosphere down to his tower, collect that energy, and then distribute it, buffer it, so to speak, and then distribute it out to the public. And so that was one indication that there is this incredible vertical electric field. Tesla knew it. You can measure it. You can go out. It's very large. It's a couple hundred volts per meter. So it's a very significant electric field. But if you just stick something up in the air and try and collect it, you're not going to get very much electricity. But when storm clouds build up, like in the case of of what would you call it, snowstorms, then the it's like a big finger pointing up hundreds of thousands of feet into the air, and it collects that electric field, and current starts to flow, and that's where the electric field comes from in nature to build the snowflakes. So at any rate, this topic will be covered again in my new book. And right now, unfortunately, I have to cut this show off just a little bit early because of production work that's going on behind the scenes here. But I'll be back next week with more information with the actual release of the new book, new release dates, etc. And I apologize for leaving a little early tonight, but due to the production of this particular show that I'm on right now, I have to cut it short just a little bit, and we'll be back next week. So once again, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night, and we'll talk to you next week.